Howdy, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's podcast is brought to you by Kaspersky. Kaspersky has opened up in Australia, I guess coinciding with their big enterprise push. So, keep an eye on those guys. The Russians are coming, if you will, ironically enough, to protect us from the Chinese, by the looks of things. Something to ponder. Anyway, this week's show is a little bit on the depressing side, I got to admit, because we're looking at patch management. Now, this is a discipline that, in my mind, shouldn't even really be a discipline. What was the number one bit of advice that consultants were giving customers 10 years ago, which was, patch your stuff, patch your software. What's the number one bit of advice that consultants are giving in 2010? Patch your stuff. I mean, isn't that brilliant? Isn't that brilliant that in 10 years we've sort of, admittedly we've come some way with the patching of the operating systems and stuff, but, long way to go. And that's, I find that a bit depressing. So why aren't people getting this? Why hasn't the market responded with whiz-bang tools that just get this job done? Well, we'll be chatting with Rich Mogul, an analyst with his company Securosis, all about this in a bit. And by the way, how awesome is Rich's name? Rich Mogul. I mean, that's right up there with Hercules Q. Rockefeller or Theophilus P. Wildebeest.
My name is Theophilus P. Wildebeest. I'm the most fertile man in the universe.
Anyway, we're chatting patch management with Rich in a bit. And contrary to what you might assume, the topic is actually pretty interesting, basically because no one's really doing patch management right. Now, in this week's sponsor interview, we will be speaking to one of Kaspersky's genuine certified Russian InfoSec geeks, Vitaly Kamlyuk. I think I pronounced that incorrectly, but Vitaly, you know I tried, buddy. And we'll be chatting to him about some interesting ransomware that's doing the rounds in the Russian Federation. And we really want to hope this stuff doesn't wind up here. Curiously enough, though, that will depend on the regulation of our telecommunications sector. What the hell am I talking about? Well, wait for the sponsor interview and you will find out. But right now, as always, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, it looks like Google et al. Weren't the only ones being hit in that massive, China coming to get you attack back in January. Intel has come out in a public statement, in a statement filed with the Securities Commission in the United States, and admitted that they got pwned as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to see some of the other companies coming out of the woodwork. Obviously the number of, 34 major companies was bandied around earlier on this year, and we've all been speculating about who they are, and I guess now Intel are not saying that they were involved in the same attack. They claim that they mentioned the Google thing only because it was topical and in the news in their Securities Commission filing. But I guess certainly Intel would fit the bill of one of 34 large, interesting companies to steal intellectual property from.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't mind going through their shizzle.
well, exactly. Yeah, and they have plenty of it in lots of important places. If you can slip bugs into the microcode or something, or get access to microcode bugs, then maybe you have tricks to escape out of virtualization, or there's lots of goodies if you can get into Intel's deep and dark secrets.
Yeah, now inserting bad stuff into the actual chip designs, that's pretty diabolical, man. I mean, that's the first thing you thought of.
Well, I'm going to assume that the bugs are already in there. You just got to find them, right?
Yeah.
Man, I mean, Intel have a long history of interesting and strange errata on their CPUs, and they're only getting more complex.
Now, still focusing on the fallout from this massive China attack on Google, the United States reckons, the US government, according to reports, reckons it may have actually identified someone who was involved in writing the malware that was used to perpetrate this attack.
Yeah, so the according to the report, the U.S. government or agents have identified that some particular Chinese guy was talking about some particular piece of code on some particular forum, and it looks like that piece of code was also involved in either the exploit or the malware that they were using post-exploitation. And, I mean, it's all a bit kind of circumstantial, but I guess the moral of the story here is if you're in the middle of writing, international cyber espionage malware,
yeah, don't post to a
about
forum.
It on a forum. Jesus.
Don't get on Full Disk asking for advice, guy.
Exactly. Yeah. But I guess that's one of the things that makes me, if that is actually a piece of code which is actually in the malware, then if anything, that discounts, the involvement of actual state apparatus, right? It makes it seem like a, your average private sector fuck up.
Yeah, but I mean, look, public sector fuck-ups are just as common, man. I mean, everyone thinks that spies are very, very well organized, but
They don't post on forums, right? There isn't some, secret espionage spy forum.com.
Yeah, I don't think it was a particularly well thought out maneuver if that happened to be the case. But the other possibility too is that someone could have just found that code snippet on the forum and gone, oh yeah, that'll do, and cut and pasted it into their code.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure on the exact discussion that they're using as evidence for this, and I guess, you know, presumably they wouldn't be saying that if it was just someone asking about a piece of common code. Like, I would like to assume that it is something that is a bit more conclusive than that.
All right, well, look, we're going to move on to a, you know, actually non-China Google hacking-related thing now. And apparently, you know, the courts in the United States, and this, you know, seems to be a fairly obvious bloody ruling, but it's, you know, I think it's an interesting enough story to pull out and mention, even though it's not technically an InfoSec story. But in the US, the FBI now is allowed to basically, if you're sharing files on a peer-to-peer network, they're allowed to go through and see what you're sharing, you know, download it. If it happens to be dodgy material, a la child abuse material, then bang, they're going to arrest you and send you off to the clink.
Yeah, so this is an interesting ruling, I guess, because in this particular case, the FBI searched some guy's LimeWire share for kiddie porn, found it, downloaded it, and then subsequently prosecuted him. And he claimed that they needed a search warrant to search his publicly shared stuff. And that to me seems pretty obviously ridiculous. Hopefully that, as you said, the ruling is fairly straightforward and obvious, and you know, the stuff's publicly available, then I don't particularly imagine that you're going to need a warrant to get that. And I suppose the interesting thing here is whether this now extends to data you put online in other forms, in social networking, in websites or other network systems, and whether or not if you've accidentally misconfigured it, like one of the stories we're going to cover a bit later on, whether or not that's actually hacking in scare quotes. To access information that's not actually protected in any manner.
Yeah. I mean, it is. Look, I find it personally a little bit reassuring that the Phoebes are allowed to actually browse through open stuff. I mean, if you're putting kiddie porn out there in shared directories through LimeWire, and the cops are actually have the resources, the time, and the inclination to actually sit there and go through your stuff and then catch you, I'm thinking, good.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Well, I suppose the thing that surprised me most about the story is what people are still using LimeWire.
Indeed. Touche, Adam. Now, look, we were talking last week about how much Adobe sucks. And look, they suck even harder because there's a nice big critical hole in their download manager, which has just been patched this week.
Seriously. Vulnerabilities and pieces of software you don't even want or need?
You've never used a download manager?
No, it's what a W gets for.
Oh, my God, you beardy Unix nerd.
Mike, I understand maybe if you're going to download Oracle and it's, 5.5 gigabytes. I know Sun has a download manager for helping you download ISOs because, it's really hard to download big things.
Okay, but basically the story is another Adobe product full of holes.
Yes, big surprise, shock, horror.
Okay, moving on. Now, another China story, but this is unrelated to the alleged attack, in January. China is now rolling out a bunch of laws that require people who want to operate websites to sort of get some sort of government permit, which involves submitting like their name and a photo and stuff like that. And I mean, that just says, you're going to wind up with electrodes on your nuts if you wind up putting up political content. I mean, it seems obvious that this is designed to stymie the flow of political debate online.
I mean, you got to admire the scale on which these dudes go ahead and do this stuff, right? I mean, censoring the internet, right? I mean, you could put up a couple of crappy web filters like we are in New Zealand and you have in Australia, or you could go ahead and get every website author to give you their photo, right? You've got to admire the scale, man. That's just ballsy right there.
Well, there's one thing that central planning style governments, communist governments love, and that's an excuse to do some admin, to expand the bureaucracy. But this is a little bit freaky.
Expanding needs of the bureaucracy, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. The glorious people's, bureau of bureauology. But this is a little bit kind of, worrying, isn't it,
for the average Chinese? Yeah, it's, I wouldn't, I suppose if I was in China, it's a different society, different, kind of set of circumstances. But yeah, this does seem pretty concerning. I mean, it's going to do nothing but stifle speech, I guess, and, that, I guess, from our worldview is a bad thing.
Now, message to China. We love buying all of your cheap stuff. I mean, looking around my office, I can't really see much in here that wasn't made in your country. So thank you. We love that. We love your cheap labor. The human rights abuses, though, kind of a problem.
Yeah, maybe stop being jerks, China. That's our message to you.
Maybe we should feel bad about buying this stuff.
Well, yeah, there is that, I suppose, like solving this problem on the demand side, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you reckon that's going to happen?
Doesn't seem particularly likely, does it?
No, it doesn't. No. Anyway, moving on to this next story, and this one, look, Microsoft did something funny, as it turns out. They did something funny at a conference that I actually attended for a couple of days last year. I went to their Tech Ed conference on the Gold Coast just to speak to a few of their guys. I interviewed the guy who handled security for Office 2010. I think I posted that in Risky Business too. Anyway, they had a big LAN set up where everyone could get on, you know, Wi-Fi LAN. Everyone could get on and just go nuts and, you know, download stuff off the internet. And that's exactly what people did. They were going berserk with torrents. So Microsoft came up with a pretty cool response.
Yeah, so apparently they went ahead and rickrolled them, which I think is great. Why the hell not? So apparently, yeah, they rigged up a system which would detect large amounts of traffic from particular MAC addresses in the network and then transparently proxy people's, I presume, outbound web requests to a site that then rickrolled them with videos of our good friend, Mr. Rick Astley. And then apparently, yeah, whenever they changed their MAC address, it would figure out what was going on and carry on doing so.
Yeah, that's nice, huh?
Punished them for using large amounts of their network for torrenting wares. Dear.
You got to admit, this is uncharacteristically cool of Microsoft.
It is pretty funny, yeah. But they've got to wonder how far up the chain it went before someone said yes. You know, you kind of get the feeling if it had gone too far up, then, you know, I don't see Steve Ballmer signing off on people getting rickrolled.
No, no, but I mean, you got to love them, like doing, I mean, that's one hell of a tar pit. That's a rick pit.
Pit of Rick, yeah. Yeah, we actually rickrolled one of our customers in a report, in a security consultancy report once, and they were most entertained.
They were most entertained? How'd you do that?
We had a bug that we could include arbitrary video in their CoughBank website, and we included Rick Astley as the demonstration link in the report.
Oh, so it's just like a cross-site scripting thing? Or?
Yeah, a little more involved than that. But yeah, the net result was they browsed to their bank website and yeah, he was never going to give them up. He was never going to let them down.
That's good, man. Neither would you. Neither would you, Adam? All right. Now, look, this is something we discussed briefly last week, which is, you know, people coming out and making declarations that Chip and PIN is completely bloody dead. I was skeptical about that. But it looks like now there's going to be a bit more investigation into that research that showed that you could actually use Chip and PIN cards without the PIN if you physically had the card. So, you know, like a stolen card or something that hadn't been cancelled, you could process a transaction without a PIN. Who's looking into this and why, Adam?
So apparently, this has been the research has been shopped around the vendors and the people who are responsible for defining the standard, the EMV standard, for chip and PIN devices, and they claim they're going to go through and actually review the findings. I've been through and read it in some detail myself now, and it seems like a pretty straightforward kind of protocol design flaw, or at least a sort of a flaw in the way that you're encouraged to implement it. So I'm interested to see exactly how they propose to fix this, because it looks quite difficult, to be honest.
It is kind of an implementation problem, right?
Yeah, it's essentially a lack of authentication on the exchange that decides exactly how you're going to authenticate a transaction, whether it's by signature or by PIN, between the smart card on the chip and PIN card and the reader itself. And that that exchange apparently is not authenticated in any strong manner. So if you can man in the middle and essentially say to the reader, yes, I'm totally going to PIN off it, and say to the card, nah, I'm totally going to signature off it, you end up with both devices being quite happy about what's going on.
That's really funny.
Yes, and as I say, I have no idea what they're actually going to try and do to fix it. You can detect it after the fact by correlating the fact that one side thought one thing and one side thought the other, because the receipt says verified by PIN and the bank's records say verified by signature. So you can spot it after the fact. And that may be some consolation for people who've actually been defrauded using this technique, which I guess is inevitable, it's going to happen, that there is some way to detect it. But then, of course, the implication of one of the reports I read was that because the banks hold a key part of that information, that they would be quite able to go ahead and you know, alter or accidentally lose the records in question that make them liable for it, as someone has previously alleged in a report that I read. But yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, really how they go ahead and mitigate it and how much kind of spin and damage control they put around this. Because to me, this looks like a pretty basic kind of, you know, fundamental flaw in the way that the protocol is designed and implemented.
Yeah, look, it sounds like a rolled gold up.
Absolutely. And in a system that, you know, presumably has been reviewed by sensible people, it does seem like a bit of an oversight.
Look, I mean, I still see the major advantage of chip and PIN being that you cannot actually clone the card. This, you know, to actually exploit this, you still need access to a genuine card.
Yes, yeah, agree.
So I don't see this as being chip and PIN broken. As I said last week, this is very interesting research, but chip and PIN ain't broken, you know? Like,
well,
let's get a grip.
Chip and PIN. If you've broken the PIN bit, then it's just a chip.
All right,
chip
okay.
Is not broken.
Chip is not broken, Pin is broken.
Pin is broken.
Broken pin.
Broken pin. Pretty hard to argue with the videos that I think the BBC had of them authorising transactions using the journalist's chip and pin card without knowing the pin. I mean, that's pretty compelling, really.
Now we're going to move on to the funniest goddamn story of quite some time.
Oh, man, this is hilarious.
This is champagne Australian politics here. Apologies if you're located outside of Australia, but look, I think you might even find this one quite funny. I'm going to walk you through basically what's happened here. Some journalists from the Sydney Morning Herald got a tip that some policy documents were basically already online at this web address that the government hadn't promoted yet. They directed their browser over there, grabbed the documents, and wrote a front page story for the Saturday Sydney Morning Herald on this like transport blueprint that, you know, wasn't supposed to be public yet. Now, this is the funny part, is the transport minister jumps up and down and starts accusing the Sydney Morning Herald of hacking.
Cue lots of jokes about hacks and hackers. So the the third party web developer or web hosting provider, I wasn't quite sure which was which, called Bang the Table. So I'm guessing they must be a designer with a name like that. Apparently they put security on the front page, but not on the pages underneath. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all of their public statements make no sense. Initially, they were said to have lodged a police report. Now they're backing away from that and saying that they haven't. But it's just really funny. And of course, the journalists. Who are known apparently around Fairfax for their fondness for using things like fountain pens, you know, and other high-tech equipment like that, have written a really funny story basically saying, what's the headline? Minister, a monkey could have hacked the secret transport site. And there's some very, very funny stuff in that story.
It's a great article. It's well worth reading if you want a good cheap laugh in your lunch break while you're listening to Risky Biz.
But there's a line in here that in the story that he wrote in the follow up to this, which says that the IT help section at Fairfax will tell you that their staff run a mile whenever I call. I am squarely in the learning disability group.
dear.
But nice bit of spin, huh?
Yeah. Well, I think the lesson we could take out of this, you know, for the listeners of Risky Biz is, you know, if someone is, if you've done something stupid, then claiming you got hacked is the first thing. Probably not the best possible response.
No, and I did try to. I left a couple of messages for the Bang the Table guys as well, and they surprisingly didn't get back to me. I even found out, you know, one of the director's Twitter IDs. You know, I'd left him a bloody. I left one of the directors a voicemail message, and then tweeted the guy saying, are you sure you're standing by your police report? This was yesterday. Are you sure you're standing by your police report? Because Fairfax, with what they're saying, it would constitute a false report. And sure enough, there was a form of retraction today that went out through the Australian Associated Press. But fun stuff, Adam. That's all we're going to have time for this week's news. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll speak to you next week.
Not a problem. Hopefully we can talk about something other than Google and China next week.
That was Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at the week's news headlines. Don't forget, by the way, that our forums at risky.biz now allow anonymous posts. So if you have a comment or a criticism, something to add, whatever, head over to risky.biz and get typing or flaming or doing whatever it is that you do. Now it is time for this week's feature interview with the awesomely named Rich Mogul from Securosis. Some of you may remember Rich from his days at Gartner, the big analysis firm. I first met him back in 2003 during Gartner's Security Summit shindig in Sydney. So Rich is an analyst, but a good one, which is oh so rare. And he's more or less out on his own these days. I mean, he's with Securosis, which is a smaller sort of boutique infosec-focused company that does some very interesting work. Now, one of the things Rich has been looking at lately is patch management. Much to his surprise, and indeed mine, patch management is still a really immature discipline. So Securosis's so-called Project Quant had a crack at defining some metrics for patch management. And the result is a very interesting paper you could find by Googling for Project Quant, as in quantify, or quantity or whatever, and patch management, those terms, you'll find it pretty easily. Anyway, Mogul and his buddies wound up doing everything from surveying CSOs about their patching processes to actually coming up with their own best practice for patch management, which I have to say actually looks pretty damn good. So I got Rich on the line and started quizzing him about this work that he's done.
Yeah, Project Quant was something that started a little bit over a year ago. It was a project that we did with Microsoft. And Microsoft kind of was interested. They said, look, nobody's really doing anything around tracking metrics for patch management. We think we do a good job at that, but we would like an independent objective model And could you guys do that? And so we kind of thought about it. And at first I thought, well, patch management, that is just incredibly boring. I was doing that when I was an IT administrator, you know, X number of years ago. I believe being a double digit at this point. And then we looked into it, and it turns out nobody's really done a lot of work there. It was really shocking considering how much of a problem it is in most organizations. So basically we went ahead and we kicked off the project. You know, the overall goal was, hey, let's give people a tool that helps them measure how well they're doing in patch management and then figure out in a very granular way where they may be having problems and how they can make improvements.
Yeah, now it's funny that you mentioned that, you know, patch management has long been a problem because, I've been around this IT security thing for, 10 years, right? And 10 years ago, people would say, life would be so much simpler for everyone if they would just patch their software. You know, here we are 10 years later and we're still saying, you know what, people's problems would be solved, a lot of them anyway, if they would just patch their software. I mean, did you find that this is still a really primitive discipline? And if so, did that kind of shock you?
Yeah, I mean, it did. The first place we started is, hey, let's see if there's a patch management framework and then we can kind of build our metrics model around that. Turns out there was no vendor-neutral patch management framework we could find anywhere. I mean, not even the most fundamental, what's a good process framework for doing patch management. So we ended up having to build that part of it ourselves, which was a bit shocking. Then we went through all the metrics, but the more interesting part is we actually also went out and did survey, and we basically got involved with the patch management community, patchmanagement.org, as well as the security metrics community and others, and did a big kind of a big survey, and we got well over 100 responses, but under 200. And what we found is generally people are reasonably mature or feel reasonably confident around Windows, but beyond that, the operating system. But beyond that, it's just an absolute mess. And as you said, I was doing this over 10 years ago. You've been doing this. I mean, we've all been there. We all know this is a problem. And even when you're using tools, it's still seems to be very definitely a problem.
Well, I mean, this is what stuns me as well. And you know, you look at last year, something like there was a report recently that said that 82% of all exploit code was targeted at Adobe software, right? Now, patching that stuff with, Windows Software Update Service, well, you can't do that. I mean, you can do it through group policy, but, it might work, right? I mean, this is one of the things that you found is that, even the deployment of patches, even if you're using patch management software, you're just pushing it out through group policy. There's no guarantee these things are actually going to install, is there?
No. I mean, how many people, I'm sure many of the listeners have installed patches and they actually, the patch didn't take properly. We're not even talking about breaking something else. We're just talking about the patch actually not being there. And I think that happens to pretty much all of us. So, that's definitely one of the big problems here. And then validating it and documenting it. And look, some of the tools do this reasonably well, but there's no tool that handles patch management across all of your platforms either. Again, it tends to be okay for Windows-based workstations, maybe a little bit on servers. It gets real messy beyond that.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what are the tools out there? We've seen stuff like, Shavlik, we've got Lumention, we've got Altiris, which is now part of Symantec. I mean, you can't use a magic quadrant because you're, ex-Gartner. So if we come up with a mystical triangle, where would they go? Which ones would be in your mystical triangle there, Rich?
The tools is actually the next part of our research to dig in more. But, definitely the ones you mentioned, I'd add Big Fix to the list, as well as a lot of people are using Microsoft WSUS, the Windows Update Server that you can deploy in an enterprise environment. And those were, a handful of the more common ones that we saw out there.
But WSUS ain't going to help you with your Adobe patches.
Although it can. There are ways that you can build packages. I believe there's ways you can build packages and put them out even over WSUS, although it's primarily designed just for the Windows updates. But anyway, this is the problem. You've got to update the operating system. You have to update your device drivers. You have to update all of your software application packages on there. And large organizations might be a little bit better at this because they tend to have a little bit more money invested. But, mid-sized organizations and small and, to be honest, even quite a few large are pretty bad overall about that. And I'm not saying that to pick on them. It's hard. The tools aren't necessarily always as good as you would want. They don't cover everything you would need. You've got different teams involved, server guys handling their servers and desktop guys handling desktops. you know, it's a very, very messy situation, and no wonder we keep having problems.
And speaking of that, I mean, how good a job are people doing out there? You mentioned that, you know, it's a bit of a mess out there, but are organizations really struggling with this? I mean, were you actually able to quantify some sort of success metric for, you know, the, you know, enterprise-sized organizations, mid-sized organizations, things like that? So, you know, you might be able to find that, say, 5% of workstations in an enterprise network with 100,000 endpoints might be non-compliant. I mean, were you able to boil it down to hard numbers like that?
No, because that takes much broader benchmarking, which we want to go ahead and do. What we did get from our patch manager results, and I apologize, I don't have the survey in front of me, is, you know, between, you know, about 40 to, I think about 60% of organizations felt that they were reasonably mature with the Windows desktop. All other areas dropped off very, very quickly.
So really that's where people are falling down. It's not necessarily third-party apps on the Windows desktop. It's more around, you know, more exotic platforms like, I don't know, Solaris on PlayStation 3 or something.
Yeah, exactly. Although, you know, remember, 60%, that means 40% of people are still immature on their Windows-based desktops. Mm. That's still a massive number.
You'd think that's kind of a problem, right?
I think it's a problem.
So, Rich, you mentioned before that as part of this Project Quant thing, you've developed a bit of a, you know, a vendor-neutral thing. I mean, Microsoft helped pay for this, but you have actually developed a vendor-agnostic patching cycle that I've actually reviewed myself, and it's nice and simple. Do you want to describe it for us?
What the framework does is it starts with, at the earliest level, monitoring for advisories. So, you know, when is a vendor, you actually have to have a process in place to figure out when a patch is released. And when you're going to have to go ahead and install that. And then it runs through all of the evaluation phases and the testing, then the installation of the patches, and at all of these phases. So basically there were 10 phases with a total of 40 steps across all of those phases. That's the level of detail we went into. We know that that's not what everybody does. We actually designed this very specifically to be a superset of potential activities because when you're building a metrics model, you know, it's absolutely important to go ahead and make sure that you have every possible thing somebody could do, and then that way whatever they are really doing will fit within that model. It also gives people something to go ahead and strive towards.
It struck me as being something, you know, best practice for extraordinarily large organizations who wanted to tick every single possible conceivable box. That's how it appeared to me.
Yeah, and exactly. We know not everybody's going to do that. That's fine. That's not what our goal was during this. You know, again, we say in all the documents, look, you know, we've designed this that your process should be able to fit in within this superset, this massive process that we have in place. So, you know, don't get too hung up on the fact that you're not doing X, Y, or Z. We're more focused on the fact that we've given you something so you can at least, you know, that will somewhat, your process will be able to fit within that and you'll be able to pull out the appropriate metrics. Or, you know, potentially even use this as something that will go ahead and you can use to actually kind of help redesign your process if you think you've got some problems with it. And so basically we start from the monitoring phase. We go all the way through the testing, all the way through the deployment, the validation that those things are deployed, the cleaning up, pulling off all the remnants. You know, some of these things you don't think about much with Windows, but it's a huge issue, particularly on servers, and then all the way through the documentation.
Now, one thing I noticed, too, is the emphasis was pretty strong on validation. And I imagine that that's probably where a lot of organizations fall down is, you know, they fire off their patch and they just go, well, that's done. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee without actually, you know, thinking to validate. Is that a problem that you've seen in many organizations?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's any problem you can think of, we've seen a lot of organizations because everybody's patching. So,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of like saying, have you ever met a sick, have you ever met an ugly kid? Well, I've met plenty of ugly kids, but there's a lot of humans on the face of the planet.
But would you say that that's an area where people are falling down harder than in others, the validation phase?
That was one of the ones where we got one of the interesting results, which is we asked, what is your technique for validating the patches were deployed properly? And I can't remember the exact number. I think it might have been 40%. I'm getting worried because I've said 60 and 40% a little too many times we've been talking here. But I think it was nearly 40% user complaints as one of the techniques. Not their only technique, but as one of the techniques for finding out if patches deployed properly.
Yeah. So there's like, you know, it's your computer's turned into a nonstop porn pop-up carnival. That tends to be an indication something's wrong.
You know, but I hate to say it. I mean, sometimes with certain things, you know, that's reasonable. I mean, because if you break it and nobody complains about it, then it's not a problem.
All right. Well, Rich Mogul, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a chat about the wonderfully exotic topic of patch management.
No problem, Patrick. And yeah, it's kind of funny. I thought this was one that, you know, that this particular topic, patch management, that would be a bit of a snoozer. And it turns out there is a heck of a lot of work to be done. So I have a funny feeling I'm going to be doing a heck of a lot more around this over the years.
Sad but true. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Rich Mogul there. Also, some of you may know Rich as the co-host of the Network Security Podcast with Martin McKee. So there you go. If you want to hear more of Rich, there is plenty out there. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Vitaly Kamluk, who's heading up Kaspersky's global research team in Japan. Well, actually, he's due to take up that position in a couple of days. He was heading up that position, I believe, in Russia and Eastern Europe, but he's just in the middle of the move. I first met Vitaly when I travelled to St. Petersburg in 2008 on what was, in essence, a Kaspersky junket. And I've got to say, he's a pretty sharp cat. We wound up having a really cool geekathon-style conversation about endpoint security, which was made doubly funny by the fact that the PR guy thought we were having some sort of hostile disagreement. He just didn't realise that that's how geeks talk when they're getting along. Funny. Anyway, Vitaly's a young guy who knows an absolute boatload about malware. I certainly learned a few things chatting to him back then in 08. So I got in touch with him when it came time to do this sponsor interview. And about a week ago, I asked him if he'd seen anything interesting that hasn't really been widely reported. Well, he came back to me with the goods and told me about a new form of ransomware he's seeing a lot of in Russia in particular. So once this stuff gets onto a host, it locks the system down and demands the user sends a text message to a premium SMS service to reactivate the system. The idea is you get a code back and it costs around $15. Now, this is a troubling development. And as you'll hear, Vitaly says the thing that makes this scam possible is the poor regulation of the premium SMS business. And we need to really watch what we're doing in other countries where we still have some form of regulation. We need to make sure we don't relax it too much, basically. Here he is.
We have spotted a huge growth of malware, which is targeting the home users and trying to ransom money utilizing the premium SMS numbers to channel the money. They change system policies and they change the user interface. They actually lock your machine, they lock your system and prevent you from logging in or using some features of your operating system. And the message which is left by the ransomware, but by the developer of the malware, says that if you want to unlock your system, you have to input the secret code, which you can receive by SMS. And to receive it, you have to send the SMS first to a premium number, and you will be charged for from $10 to $15. Yeah, it is a kind of ransomware, but utilizing premium SMS numbers.
So what are the authorities actually able to do about that in Russia? Because I imagine that this is a pretty clumsy way of making money, a clumsy way of taking money, because it's easy to trace. Is that right?
Well, it is not that easy to trace, as you may think first, because there is way to register and to use and to build such services with premium SMS numbers totally anonymously. So I think this is a kind of a flaw in the current laws which exist in Russia, which let the users register and utilize the services to build their own businesses fully anonymously.
So are you saying that the sort of regulation around premium SMS numbers in Russia is so lax that anyone can just set up a premium SMS number and start making money?
Exactly. And you don't even need to go and sign a contract with some company, because you can do that through the internet. And of course, you can stay anonymous by registering and getting such an account to utilize these premium SMS numbers.
All right. So you say there's been an explosion in the number of these scareware products in Russia, in the Russian Federation. Do you think that this is something, I mean, we do have better telecommunications regulations, you know, in most of the countries where people listen to this podcast, like Australia, the US and the UK. Do you think we'll see modified versions of this scareware to take other sorts of payments? Or do you think this is just something that's going to stay in Russia?
Well, I am not a big specialist in the laws which exist in Australia. But if there is a flow, if there is an opportunity for some businesses to register and provide such services anonymously, well, there will be a growth of such applications. Well, what we have observed in other countries which restricted short SMS services, premium numbers, they don't have such a problem. And those countries which have a very strict regulations regarding this problem, they do not experience the same problem. So it actually depends on your regulations. It's very important.
So is there anything different about the way that these particular bits of scareware are getting onto people's systems? Is it coming in as part of a shareware package, or is it coming in via an exploit, or how's it coming in?
Well, we have seen quite a few of different ways of such applications getting on the end user's machines. They are utilizing existing botnets. They are propagating over the botnets. They are trying to attack you while you're visiting a website with an exploit. They are trying to send spam messages, including the links to these malicious pages. They are attaching to the non-legitimate software, like they're attaching the executables to different crack softwares and crack tools and so on. So they're really using all possible ways to propagate their applications to as many users as possible. It seems to be very, very profitable according to the speed of growth of such applications and to the number of different types of applications being developed.
Once it actually gets onto the system, I mean, it is locking people out, but is it doing that in a robust way? Is it actually using solid encryption to encrypt the hard drive? Or, I mean, how's it working?
The process and the methods they're using are quite simple. They're just locking the user screen, and maybe advanced user or more technically skilled user can just boot from an external drive and fix the system on his own, but the most of the home users and office users, they are not capable of doing that, and that is why it's still a big problem. Despite of the low profile development, this is still a big problem.
Okay, so really it's not actually damaging the systems that much, it's just, you know, inconveniencing people and demanding that they pay to get their access back.
Exactly.
Okay, Vitaly Kumlik, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Vitaly Kumlik on the line from sunny Russia there. And I was very lucky to get him before he jumps on that plane for Japan too. So thanks to Kaspersky for sponsoring this week's edition of Risky Business. And that's it for this week's edition of the show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to jump into the forums, you know, comment, flame, whatever. And I should be posting something into Risky Business 2 tomorrow as well. So I hope you can download that. Enjoy.